Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Bowlology Report. Joining me as always, Bradley Bad Boy Hodgie. How you been since the last podcast, mate?
Good, Flem. I can't say it's been super exciting. It's been a bit Groundhog Day-ish, there's no doubt. Bill Murray would know exactly what I'm experiencing for the last 6 to 8 weeks. Pretty boring breakfasts, meandering on to dinners, and really settling on the couch for Netflix. That's probably about it, Flem.
Can you give us something on Netflix? What's new? Because it's been 2 weeks.
As I mentioned before, a lot of my love is towards the Danish, Finlandish, Scandinavian crime thrillers.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're called. I don't know. All I know is that they're deep and dark, and it annoys the hell out of my wife while she's watching it. So she goes, and I get to watch it peacefully and quiet. It's magnificent.
And what I like, our Finland, we were number one in Finland for cricket podcasts.
They know that they must have hacked into my Netflix account to know that I have a passion and love for the productions that they produce over there, Flem. So maybe they're repaying the debt, which we love our Finlandish viewers. We
good need swing bowlers. Keep coming up. Good yep. swing bowlers.
I heard they're good. Finish. I heard they're pretty good spin bowlers. I mean, not sure. I mean, imagine they get a bit of ice on the surface of the synthetics over there at some stage. So they're like Warnie. I mean, if you can turn
it on. You know it's going to hurt them. In Scandinavia, no sweat on the ball. They're saying no saliva and no sweat. You don't sweat over there. You're cooked.
Well, maybe they might have to employ one of our spin whisperers, our doctor that we may have on the show today. Maybe even fly over there as a little contra deal and help him out to get past this really testing time with CV-19.
Don't worry about our guests who we're going to get to. Just get Merv Hughes over there. He'd sweat. He'd sweat in igloos.
Yeah, but no one would play because he stinks as well, I reckon, Flem as well. So you've got a bit of an issue. They're quite a clean environment over there. They're big on renewable energy, all sorts of things. I'm not sure the big fella be welcome over there. I mean, you used to room with him. What about those farts he used to do every evening after 5 pizzas, 10 beers and a couple of Cokes?
And in horrendous. The morning, I've spoken to some doctors and you can't do it, but mentally – he'd actually built them up that much. He had it regulated half an hour before we left for the ground every day. Big, loud, and you could smell it in China. I tell you where we're going number one this week in Cricket Podcast, Canada. And we want to say good day to our host of loyal listeners over there, John and Brad and Chuck. I think there's a Chuck. Because this man was an overnight sensation after scoring the fastest World Cup ever at that stage in 2003. But we know, Hodgie, we're an ex-teammate of this man, that it took a long time to be an overnight sensation in New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia. He's now the spin whisperer helping out the GOAT, Nathan Lyon. It's, of course, Johnny D, John Davison. D, great. Thanks for joining us on the Bowlology Report.
What an introduction. Thanks, boys. Good to see you. It's been a while. Have a chat to you, Hodgie, offline on some LinkedIn stuff, because my job's been slashed quite a bit. Like, all the pathways, under-17s tournament gone. I think they're going to keep running 19s tournament, but with limited, someone in the background there. and Sophie, with limited preparation. So I just don't have the budget there. So, you know, Adam Holyoke and myself, who were doing the Pathways job for Queensland Cricket, were now consulting, I suppose, coming just a couple of sessions a week. So, yeah, we're, you know, looking for other things to do to fill our time. But in terms of training with the Bulls there, with a lot of one-on-one training at the moment, and we're lucky enough to be outdoors up here, so it's manageable.
And just your thoughts on that, mate. I mean, the Pathways, I mean, I really struggle to see how monetary value and that's cut out of that Pathway program, because, I mean, even cast your way back to 25 years, we all started through juniors under 17s, under 19s. I just can't stipulate that the value on that is unheralded, to cut funding from that and cut that program. It must be devastating for you that's seeing the growth of these young kids through the Pathways and represent not only their states but the countries.
100%. I think we're, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot a bit, because, like, the men's game drives the revenue in cricket, and if we're not developing the next generation, then, you know, we make all our Cricket Australia makes all their money when we're highly ranked in the world and people want to watch us play. I think if we don't invest in the youth, we're going to, you know, we're not going to have as good of players coming through. We're not going to accelerate their development as needs be. And I think, like, particularly in a highly skilled sport, which cricket is, I think it's probably one of the toughest games to master in the world. You know, you play in different conditions and different opposition, and I think that we really need to be developing their skills when they're young. We can't be working and making them better when they're older.
Oh, it's too late. Hey, Dave, you got a feel from the vibe from the players, you know, with all the depletion of coaching around them?
Yeah, look, I think though, like, it's tough, and in the fact that you know, it just comes down to money, and you know, I don't know the finance side of things well enough to comment on it, but it's sort of, I don't understand why we're all of a sudden losing so many people out of the game, and it's a tough situation for a lot, not just coaches, but a lot of people involved in cricket.
It's a bizarre one, Johnny, because, I mean, I think I'm pretty sure in the strategic plan of Cricket Australia, and their aim is to be the number one sport in Australia, viewed and participated. Now, if you take away from grassroots cricket, I'm just not sure how you're meant to achieve that. I mean, this is in the strategic plan of Cricket Australia. It's a real tough one to nut out, but... Yeah, I'm just sort of staggered that all of a sudden there is that loss of people who have been involved in making this great game so good as what it is today. And I'm not sure how it's going to be replaced, to be honest. I'm sure you're in the front line of it. But certainly here in Victoria, many people who have got the game well and truly in the right areas, in the country areas, developing young kids. You know, my girl Sophie has a whack there and, you know, the cricket on the weekend, T20 blast, you know, the effect is going to be huge. And, you know, you've seen it pretty closely. It just must be hard to take, and no one's sure what the future is going to look like.
That's exactly right. And I've started to think creatively in terms of, you know, trying to fill gaps and whatnot in the coaching world. Other sports pay... You know, people pay to be involved in high performance programs and go to, you know, private academies and things like that. So, you know, the what people have taken for granted, I suppose, in terms of associations providing programs for them to be involved in, then, you know, maybe someone's going to have to step up and develop pathways programs that people pay for. To be involved in. And there's definitely an appetite. People want their kids to be good cricketers, and kids want to be good cricketers. So for that to happen, then they may be having to go to their own wallets.
Well, it's going to pressure the volunteers even more, who I'd imagine are pretty stressed. And I mean, we're all involved locally at cricket clubs. So that's not going to help. The only positives I've seen in Victorian cricket is to get rid of the zonal pathway, and the Dowling Shield is back. And I've been big on this for the last 5 years, because it's going to help, as long as the club, they've got to give the club resources though to help them out. But for their development, to actually get them into the system, in the, I hope it's under 17 level, you know, play low seniors of that thing. It could be actually a really positive, but it's going to put more strain on the clubs if they're not going to be backed financially.
Well, that's right. I know. Look, I suppose if you know, your state associations aren't going to be paying for a high performance program, then that money would go back to the clubs. How it's then used by the clubs, do the clubs have the right resources? I know in Queensland, the clubs up here, in terms of facilities, not many clubs have turf wickets to train on. So I think that's going to be a real backward step in terms of, kids, particularly fast bowlers, running and bowling on hard surfaces rather than, running in at Allan Border Oval and the great facilities there. It's going to be a stretch for the clubs, I agree.
But, if we're optimistic, we hope it's short term. If the summer, if India come out, the Bash is played, yes, the revenue is going to be affected by the lack of crowds. But by this time next year, we're hoping we're running into an Ashes series, crowds are back in. So what's the plan in actually resource or getting the resources back in? That's going to be the key, isn't it? Like, I'll be hoping that three quarters of the people or those roles will be back in place.
Well, I think that's the businesses that are going to thrive and do best through this period. I think the ones that are going to have, one, good leaders, creative thinkers, and being able to keep the people on board that you want to be working with and know that are going to make a difference to your company in the future down the track. So if you lose good people now and they go off and do other things, then it's going to be hard to get them back.
And cricket hasn't had a good history on that, though, Johnny, about getting those decisions right, actually. It's been more inclined to line the pockets of someone who likes to fill a mignon steak at the first day of the test than actually looking after the good people that put the time and effort in. But we'll see. Only time will tell.
Yeah, that's right. We'll have to see what happens.
Good chat, boys. Okay, we're going to move on to, a bit more positive flavour to it. Dee, I reckon the listeners will want to hear how a guy that played state cricket or started New South Wales District Cricket, State Cricket Victoria, South Australia, ends up dominating for Canada in a World Cup.
Yeah. How far you want to go back, Flem?
Your grandfather's grandfather?
Well, let's go. I qualified for Canada by being born there. I was born on Vancouver Island on the west coast of Canada, and only lived there for a couple of months before my Australian parents decided to move back to Australia. So mum and dad were there for 5 or so years. My older sister was born there as well. Not sure the reasoning for coming back when I was born, but I won't go there. And so 18 years later, I heard that Neil Maxwell, who Hodgie played with at the Melbourne Cricket Club. Yep. So when I was 18, I reckon Maxie would have been a couple of years older than me, I think, two or three. And I heard that he was playing for Fiji. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty cool. I wonder if Canada's got a team. And so so this is in 1988. And I penned a letter, didn't write an email. I penned a letter to the Canadian Cricket Association, just explaining that I was a young first grade cricketer in Sydney and wondering if you had a cricket team, and if so, where do you play and all this sort of stuff. Never got a reply. And then in...
No, they were on email by that stage, Johnny B.
No, I don't... Well, maybe they were. Maybe I just didn't have a computer. So what year would it be? We were in Vic. So in the 90s, we were playing... So I was playing for Victoria. So it would have been mid to late 90s. I got an email via the Victorian Cricket Association asking me if I'd ever considered playing for Canada. So I replied to them, and then we just went from there. I went over and played some qualifying tournament, World Cup qualifying tournaments in, that would have been 2001. I think I went a couple of years before that. But then 2001, we played a qualifying tournament in Toronto, which we qualified third, which was the last position to get in. So the top
who are the other teams in there, Johnny?
So we played Scotland in the 3-4 game to so the winner of that went through. Yeah. And then would have been Holland. And
good team,
Ireland,
Holland.
Holland and Ireland, I would have thought.
Good team, Holland. Anyone that gets runs against Holland, you're in good touch. Very good, yeah, very good form in World Cups.
That I think runs against, it should be List A, a bit like Dizzy's 201 against Bangladesh. So bad luck.
They're a test team. They're a test team. They weren't List A.
Yeah, Hodge loses his 100. So, you know, when you hit the tournament 2003, do you remember? Did you have team goals, or was it just a bonus to be there?
Team goals, that's a tough one. Like, so we lost our Jeff Thomas, who was an Aussie, Queensland Australian. He coached us through the 2001 qualifiers, and then about 6 weeks before the tournament, the West Indies offered Gus Logie free of charge. So Canadian Cricket sacked Jeff Thomas and brought in Gus Logie, which was horrible because Tomo had done a lot of work, you know, and spent a lot of time in Canada, and the boys really enjoyed working with him. But couldn't go past the West Indian of the dominant 80s teams to come in and coach for free.
Was he any good, Gus?
No, he's probably not listening, but you know,
we have got a strong listening audience in that neck of the woods, but more stronger in Europe and also Russia, right. And
my guess is
the block
listening.
Finland, yep.
All right, I think Matthew Jenkinson, you know, remember Matthew Jenkinson from Victoria played for Fitzroy? I think he's coaching Finland, so he'll be listening in.
I reckon I played against him. He played for Caulfield, played final against him. Really good bowler.
Yeah, that would have been. Yeah, you get a few.
Yep. And of course, Gus Logie played for South Melbourne, the Bloods.
Yes, you would have played with him.
I didn't play a game the whole year for some reason, but he got a lot of runs. But so you get there, and what's the expectations?
Oh, so the expectations, look, I think. My the way I spoke to the boys was we didn't want to embarrass ourselves. Like, you wanted to, you know, we probably couldn't compete in terms of skill and whatnot, but it was like you can compete with passion and you compete with, you know, fitness and things like that, which we weren't fit enough. But anyway, the majority weren't. But we had a meeting before it started, because I put my hand up and said, look, I want to open the batting. And like, leading into it, I'd batted probably 7 or 8 or something like that, and didn't set the ball on fire. Got a couple of, you know, quick 30s here and there and things like that. And I said, look, I want to open the batting. Let's have a crack up top and have a crack early, see if we can get away. And we had it went to a vote, because Gus didn't really know me or whatever. So it went to a vote in the team, and I think I scraped in by one vote. I voted for myself, so I think that got me over the line to open the batting.
So it wasn't a strategy coming into the tournament. You've got there and just thought, you just
yeah, look, I think, no, I think I've done it, crack. I've done it a couple of times.
But it wasn't locked in.
Very, very success. No, it wasn't locked in. And so it came to a vote, and like the majority were like, "Oh no, it's too risky," and all this. And I was like, "Oh come on, just give us a go."
Yeah.
Anyway, got it over the line. And then I had, you know, I had sort of doubts. I said, "Shit, what have I done here? You know, I'm going to be facing some good bowlers, and you know, if anyone can swing it at pace, I'm not going to get bad on it." And I figured there was going to be a few of those sort of guys going around. But it was an interesting experience in terms of now I was a top order batsman. I got treated like a top order batsman. So we were training like a first class team. You'd go to these great facilities through South Africa, and you'd have net bowlers and things like that, and you could bat for as long as you liked, rather than being, you know, in state cricket, you know, fringe sort of player or just in the team batting down the order, and you get a couple of throwdowns from the assistant coach at the end of a session. So I was probably went into it, you know, very well prepared. And then in terms of the self-belief part, we did our warm-up games in Joburg. So we were at the Sand Sun in Joburg. And I think that was Hodgie, were you at that World Cup 2003?
No.
I'm trying to think where the Aussies were.
That was Ian Harvey, Bickle.
Yeah.
Bickle had a sensational 2003 World Cup, I think.
Simo really announced himself.
Yeah, Simo did really well. Yeah.
But yeah, they may have been at the Sand and Sun for sure, Johnny, I reckon. You might be right.
Yeah, so that, I think that the Aussies were like an hour out of Joburg. There's a sort of a...
Victoria?
Bit of a, no, not Pretoria. It's I can't remember. Anyway, they must have had a day off, because I was walking back from the pool, and Warnie was sitting in the sort of outdoor al fresco bar part of the hotel. And he's like, "Dave," and I'm like, "Oh fuck, there's Warnie." And I went over and, "What are you doing here?" And he goes, "Oh, we've got the day off. Came into the Big Smoke," and he goes, "I just wrote an article in the Herald Sun," and I was like, "Oh yeah." And he goes, "It was all about the top six players to look out for in the World Cup." And he goes, "And I wrote you as one of them." I was like, "Fucking what?"
Oh, yeah.
So that sort of pumped me up and gave me a heap of confidence. And I thought that's pretty cool. And anyway, gave me a bit of self belief, I suppose. I don't think he was talking about my batting, but. but it gave you a bit of self-belief anyway. So,
and what was Warnie rocking at that stage? Was he just about to leather some coconut oil on, sunbake, and just get the vibes out there?
No, he was like pretty well dressed and just, you know, cool vibe at the bar, mate, I think. Yeah.
Scoping the bar. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. And that was what he got sent home from that tournament, didn't he? So it must have just been just previous to that. So yeah.
And what about first game? You win.
Yeah, first game.
You beat
awesome.
Bangladesh. So what were the celebrations? That was awesome. What about when you felt that we're going to win this game? Bangladesh.
We didn't. I think we got 180 at Durban. It was like pretty quick bouncy wicket. I didn't get many. I got 8 by Tazza pretty early. Ian Billcliffe from New Zealand, Canadian. He was like me, born over there to parents who were school teachers. I think he got 70-odd and got us up to 180, which probably didn't think was enough. And then big Austin Codrington, the Jamaican plumber, just kissed the wicket beautifully and took edges and the blokes plucking them in slips. Don't know how they were catching them. It was pretty cool. And I think we got them out for 140 and like won it pretty easily.
Yeah.
So Austin Codrington took the last wicket. I caught it at mid wicket. It was off the splice, running backwards, reasonable catch, nothing special. And I chucked the ball and it went out of the stadium. I threw He got 5 far with his ball, and I threw it out of the stadium and never got it back. So he wasn't too happy with me. But yeah, that was the highlight as a team for the tournament. Yeah, the boys love that. It was good fun.
And so good performance against Kenya. Next game, then a shocker. Sri Lanka all out for 36. So you're hoping that wasn't the trend, but there was a turnaround leading into that West Indies game.
Yeah, so I remember the Sri Lanka game. Like Gus Logie before the game got everyone together and said, "All right, everyone hold hands and we're going to pray." And I was like, "What the fuck? We haven't done this before." So I was like, "Why are we changing? You know, everything we've done for years, and now we're going to like stand up and sing pray. Kumbaya together." So that was weird, and it obviously didn't work because we got knocked over 36. And then, next game, I actually had a bit of a run in before the next game against West Indies because I'd sacrificed playing the last couple of Shield rounds for South Australia. GC, Greg Chappell, had been nice enough to we had a bit of an agreement that if we didn't look like making the Shield final, then I could play in the World Cup. That was the agreement. But I would have, you know, probably made more money to stay at home and play the last couple of Shield games. And then going into this West Indies game, one of our better players, Sanjay Thurasingham, he was a very good fast bowler, played first-class cricket in Sri Lanka. I think you played against him, Blam, at the Commonwealth Games. Sanjay, you would have opened the bowling. I think you got Mark Waugh out, testing your memory there.
Yeah, testing the memory.
I'm sure you remember nicking off a few Canadian boys, but probably not.
I don't remember the watching. 5 for 15 off 10. No, their top order appeared. They'd never seen an in swinger before at that stage.
Did they count to your first class or your ODI stats?
Nah.
Good call.
Disappointed with that. They would have got the average down, but they were good fellas. Big Connington. I remember having a beer with him.
George.
But what happened to the Sri Lankan quick? Yeah.
Yeah, so he had a bit of a sore back and whatnot. Our team doctor, who wasn't a doctor, he was a massage therapist, he ruled him out, apparently ruled him out, didn't give him a fitness test or anything like that. And I'm like, what are we doing? Why aren't we playing our best team? And Gus basically gave it to me and said, "Oh, you don't back all these other guys, and mate, some of the other guys can barely catch." And I was like, "Gus, surely you know that this guy's a better player than these other guys you're talking about." And anyway, I had a bit of a toe-to-toe because I was like, "We've got to play our best team."
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck this. I don't really want to play if we're not going to try and, you know, put our best foot forward every game, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, walked away from warm-ups, went back into the room and said to the manager, "Fucking get me out of here. I want to go back and play Shield cricket."
Wow.
The captain, Joe Harris, he was a beauty. You would have played against him too, Flemo. You would have captained the team in Commonwealth Games. He came in. I got on really well with Joe. He was an alcoholic, so, you know, we spent a bit of time. Oh, that's not fair. if he's listening, that's not fair. He's probably not an alcoholic. He enjoys a drink.
But he doesn't go to the meetings. As long as you don't go to the meetings, you're fine.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Doesn't recognise him. Doesn't recognise it. He came in, "Come on, mate, you cool down," blah, 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 and he won the toss and we're batting. So I padded up and went and sat out in the front of the rooms on my own and then just went out and batted, and it was probably one of those days where, you know, it was a beautiful day. The wicket was one hit the middle of the bat early, like a defensive shot early. And I thought, wow, this wicket's beautiful. And then, just sort of gained a bit of momentum from there and chanced my arm and hit a few out of the middle. It was great.
A few amazing shots of extra cover, Johnny, early on in your innings. And then I think it was Mervyn Dillon who...
Yep.
Wasn't the quickest West Indian fast bowler you come across. He was probably 140, but stupid enough to keep banging it in short. And you were good enough to keep hooking him into the stands. It was good fun to watch. It must have been an amazing feeling especially racing towards 100 on that. When did you start thinking about it? Did you get nervous? Did you look up at the scoreboard and think, this is not real? Or I'm just two shots away?
There was a bit of this isn't real. I don't think I really looked at the scoreboard, but Merv Dillon was banging him in probably a little bit short, thinking that he could intimidate us Canadians. We played at in Pretoria at Centurion, and it's at altitude, so you just got the ball in the air, a few top edges, and it just sailed. And and then Vasper Drake, Merv Dillon got taken off, and Vasper Drakes came in and sort of went shorter and faster and top
longer
a couple of him, and it was. And I think Michael Holding was commentating, and I think he said, "Oh, the West Indians have left their brains on the bus," or something like that. And it was actually
on the field. What are they thinking? This Canadian are they going at each other? Are they laughing, or what's going on?
Well, I don't think they obviously wouldn't have done too much homework on us, or just thinking that they'd knock us over pretty easily. And at one stage, I think probably in about the 15th or 16th over, they were allowed to have, what are the rules then? Were they three out or four out? Must have been four out. Four or five out.
I thought it was two, three. I thought it was two, then three, then four.
Yeah, maybe. I think they had at a stage where they were allowed to have three out, they only had two out. and they were going at 10. So, it was interesting to see them under pressure, I suppose, and trying to think on their feet. Just seeing them a little bit rattled was good. But in terms of thinking, oh wow, that's not real. When I got the 100, Daryl Hare was umpiring, and it came up on the it came up on the big screen that it was the fastest 100 in World Cup history, and that's when I went, holy shit, that's unbelievable. and Daryl Hare looked at me, and because I'm sure I'd batted 11 in Shield cricket in games that he'd umpired before, and he looked at me and goes, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well played, John Davison. Very well played. What a shot down the pitch, and he said it right in the middle.
Now, Johnny, was there any close decisions? Because Pubic, being a New South Welshman, would have known that you're a New South Welshman. When I ever went to the SCG, there was always a couple of dodgy decisions come our way, especially the Dino when he was looking good. Did the Pubic look after you on that given day or not?
I got hit on the toe early by Pedro Collins. They swung one back. Which must have been pretty close, because it hit me tight right on the top of the foot. And that would have been at Daryl's end. It must have been Daryl's end, yeah. And then I hit one into my foot that rolled back and hit the stumps, and the bales didn't move. But that wasn't a decision. That was just a bit of luck. And then I chipped one or hit one off my toes that Shiv Chandrapal possibly had the opportunity to take a good catch and grasped it.
And D, one of the most unbelievable ones was the actual catch to dismiss you. Like, Tony Cozzi is going, Vasper Drakes hasn't read that at all. And then he takes one of the greatest catches I've ever seen.
All right. Vasper Drakes took an unbelievable catch. As you said, Tony Cozzi thought he'd really stuffed it up, but probably misjudged it, coming a bit too far, and then obviously very athletic and recovered beautifully, caught it horizontally going backwards with a little bit of a roll after it. And and the disappointing thing was, I think it was the 21st over on 111, and got through their majority of their attack, and Wavell Hines came on to bowl his part-timers, and I just didn't have the discipline to just knock it to the guys on the boundary and pick up some easy ones. But,
you would have got 300.
You threw away 300, Johnny. But it's something for those people who have never got to centuries, Flemmo. You've got to understand that when someone like Wavell-Hines comes on with that medium pace junk, all you're thinking then is you shifted from now, I haven't just got the fastest 100. I can go with Yuvraj Singh here and get the maximum sixes. I can go six sixes in and over. It really comes off.
200.
You don't get an opportunity to get in that zone every often. That was it's a disappointing end with Wavell-Hines. But he snagged a few cheeky wickets in his time, the old Wavell.
Yeah. I must admit, in a World Cup 2007, I got to commentate on radio when Herschel Gibbs hit six sixes against the Dutch, wasn't it, at St. Kitts?
It was.
Was it?
It was.
Yeah, it was.
It was about 3 days after my century against Holland.
Hey, come on. This day. Hey,
Dan Van Bunge, I think?
Yeah, he didn't really go on, surprisingly enough. Well, not in the cricketing world, but the Windies get the runs pretty quickly, but you play New Zealand, I think, the next game, and then you start to be a bogeyman for them. Not just this World Cup, but other ones. So you just got on another roll again. And how did the Kiwis handle it?
Well, let's go back to the West Indies chase. Brian Lara got 70-odd off 30 balls. So I thought I was going to have the fastest World Cup for about 2 hours. and then he got bowled by Nicholas De Groot, who is about 4 foot 10, just 115 straight ones, and somehow Brian missed one.
He was vulnerable to that. We've seen it in the past when Zoe Goss ripped his middle poles out. this is just planning from Canada.
Well, why didn't we get Justin Langer to bowl to him more then?
Correct. He would have averaged five if Justin
Langer
had bowled.
Sounds like healthy bowling.
I would have thought Buchanan would have been switched on to this planning, but he obviously wasn't. Surprise, surprise. Yeah.
Oh, so yeah, relief when Brian gets out.
Oh, yeah. That was, I gave Nicky a low five. New Zealand. So we played them at Benoni. That's probably the best I've ever hit the ball back that game against New Zealand. Jacob Oram, what are you doing? Swinging? No swing.
I'm trying to reenact your innings and see if I can, but no, I'm losing it.
Opened the batting again, got away to a quick start. They got 50 off 25 balls, got to 70 odd, and then I think we lost a couple of wickets, and we had five overs where I scored a single off the first ball of every over, and we only scored five runs for five overs. And then same thing. You know, I think it was Chris Harris bowling, and I tried to lift up, you know, keep the run rate going and hold out down at long on again. I hit the ball beautifully that day.
That's gone all the way. That's six, a maximum for John Davison. The fourth over finishes on a high note for him. 21 now for no wicket.
There he goes on the leg side. What a shot this is. It's gone behind the roof. Take a while for the ball to come back, but this guy is a sensation.
And then had a couple of other good innings against New Zealand and a couple of other World Cups, which was, I think they thought I could play. But.
And so overall, Dean, I mean, so the team get a win. They have a player that scores 100. Personally for you, it must have given you a lot of confidence because you took the most wickets as well. You're obviously bowling really well. After that, you know, what did that mean for Canadian cricket, you know, post-World Cup? Did they jump? Did they actually, use it or leverage it as much as possible, or did it just go back to normal?
So we played. So we had good funding from the ICC. We played 2003, 2007, 2011. So that would have been, you know, good funding for the Canadian cricket programs over that time. Unfortunately, now they've slipped way down. They've still got a couple of decent players that play for them, but the professionalism and the funding's not there. So I spoke to a few of them not long ago and said, you know, you guys have got to make your own legacy now and start where we did. You know, when we first started, we didn't have the same amount of funding as, you know, we did when we qualified for the World Cup. So it's up to them. They've got a huge amount of people who play cricket there. The club scene, particularly in Toronto, is, you know, pretty strong. Some of the most passionate cricket I've played is that club cricket in Toronto, where it's almost tribal. Well, it is tribal. Like, you've got teams that are, you know, Sri Lankan teams and Pakistani teams and, you know, certain religious teams. And so it's, they play with plenty of passion, I'll put it that way.
Hodge, did you get over there? Did you get a T20 comp over there in Canada?
No, unfortunately, I didn't make the Canadian Premier League. I did try, but, I mean, sometimes you just pass your best, don't you? So if you thought about throwing a lifeline out to them, Johnny, and saying, you know, look, I'm happy to come out of retirement. You know, a bit like, we went to India not long ago, representing Australia. And I'll tell you who came out and absolutely poleaxed Ben Lachlan all over the place was Kulawitha Rana. Remember?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So him and Sunath were the main ones that got the Sri Lankans off to a fly in their World Cup.
Was that a cop? You sound like a dog. Was that?
That was me dog, bloody thing. Come here, woman. I think it's... So I don't know whether there's something where you can maybe write a letter again or an email to the Canadian board and say, listen, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I've been training the nets at Allan Border Field. Do you think I can get you a quick 5:30 or 15 if you're looking for it? And bowl you.
So you're talking the over 50 circuit?
No, I'm talking the main game. You only need four or five weeks of training. That's all you need.
I tried to bowl today. The wicket is getting longer and longer.
Well, we've both brought up the 50 this year, haven't we, Dee? So, Hodgie's still got a few years to go. Hodgie, I don't know if you know this fact about Johnny Davidson, and you're a fine off spinner, under bowled off spinner yourself, Bradley Hodge. And I know you modelled your action on Jimmy Laker, who blitzed the Aussies in 1956, took 46 wickets, I think, in 5 test matches, including 19 wickets. 90 at the Oval. Who do you think's got the second best first class figures of all time?
As an off spinner?
Just yeah.
There has to be some dude with 17 wickets in a match. Or you're talking one day cricket?
No, you're right. And you know that dude, we're talking to him now. He took 17 for 137 in a first-class game against America. Dee?
Really?
Was there a chance to get all 20 or not?
Well, who definitely, because I was captain. I was captain, so...
he bowled 412 overs.
Mate, I'm not lying. I'm not lying to you. So we had an opening bowler who... I think his name was Easton Sinatavi, something like that. And I hadn't seen him bowl before. He was from Manitoba. And they said, all right, he's been picked open to bowling. And the wicket looked nothing like the one behind Flem. It was like the clay courts of Roland Garros. and as soon as I saw it, I thought, the game was in Florida at in Fort Lauderdale. Yep. And it was, I think it was one of the first games there. It was a newly made ground. And I gave him one over and he went for 8. He just dragged a couple of down to the US opening batter who pulled him through mid-wicket in front of square twice. And I thought, oh, left-hand opening batter on this wicket, I'm going to have a crack at this guy. So that was the only over he bowled for the match. And I bowled every over at that end for the rest of the game. So I gave myself every chance to get 20 and it didn't quite pay off.
But you reckon he looks back and says what a great captain John Davison was and has a great memory of that game, the young man.
Oh, I'm sure he was playing for the team and enjoyed the victory.
No doubt the Canadians would have taken the win over the USA, surely.
Oh, 100%. That's the
huge.
Yeah, it's the oldest rivalry in cricket, if you're not aware. The first international game of cricket was played between Canada and the US. Yeah. So there you go.
Dee, I reckon it's time to have a look at your domestic career. You know, you started New South Wales. We played underage cricket against each other, didn't we? Me for Victoria, yeah. You New South Wales. What about the move to Victoria? How long in the making? Was there any deals put out there, or did you just back yourself to come down, play grade cricket and get yourself into the state team?
So the story there was I went to the cricket academy when I was probably 22, and Hodgie was in my intake, as was Simon Cook, the two Victorians. Enjoyed both their company.
Similar personalities? Did you find they had similar Johnny personalities?
Johnny was just opposite the hallway to us with Diva, so we were actually very close.
Yeah, you're in with Murray Goodwin, and
what was Hodgie providing back then?
Plenty of laughs, a bit of immaturity.
a lot of immaturity, actually.
Some very good athleticism. What an athlete! We had a great intake. We had good fun.
I think Rod Marsh took great pleasure in punishing me for the most of the 6 months. To be honest.
He didn't give me much time, and I remember getting called into his office once, and I think I got blamed for loading a lot of the guns that you fired, Hodgie. So I think you're a bit of a bullet loader, Davison. I thought I'd take offense to that. But anyway,
we've got to get back to that coaching, haven't we? Last names only.
Yeah. You probably didn't even know my first name. But anyway, it was good fun. But anyway, going back to your original question, I couldn't see myself getting a game for New South Wales because Greg Matthews was just winning games for New South Wales all the time. So I was like, I wanted to play. And, you know, after having that experience with that intake of fantastic cricketers and quite, you know, probably half of them were already playing first-class cricket, I had the desire to play. The last game we played for the academy team, we played against Victoria, second 11. I played pretty well. I spoke to, I spoke to Hodgie about it too, and Hodgie said we don't have a lot of spinners in Victoria, other than Warnie, obviously. And so I spoke to Dav Watmore, who was coaching the second 11 team there. I said, what sort of opportunities are there? And just sort of went from there. I think I went to Pran Cricket Club where Dav was involved with there. They, I think they, in terms of the deals that you're talking about, Flam, I think they bought me a mattress, queen size, with some sheets, which I was pretty happy with. They had something to sleep on. And, went through club cricket. You know, there was no promises. I loved my time in Melbourne and, a couple of years playing club cricket sort of forced my way into the squad, which was a real blessing and an opportunity which I really, really enjoyed.
And I think back then as well, Johnny, I think there was a real, that was a real sort of state of origin culture, you know, where it was Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and WA and Tassie. I think there was a lot of respect actually for players at that stage who actually did make the effort to travel in their ambitions to play state cricket because it didn't happen very often at all. So I know from the state's point of view, Victoria, we were automatically respectful and understanding of what everyone wanted to achieve. And I think it was almost seamless that, you know, a blue bag was accepted into, you know, Victorian dressing room with no problem. It's something which hadn't often been done. And I think you and also then Matthew Mott followed suit, the Sean Flegler as well. So a couple of really good close friends had a huge impact in Victoria for a long period of time. It was really a positive influence for our group to have an injection of other youthful people to come in as well.
Yeah, and I think you know, the three names you mentioned, you know, we all ended up living together, and, you know, we were very, very like-minded sort of people, I suppose. You know, we were chasing that game of, you know, chasing the opportunity to play first-class cricket. You know, I found first-class cricket really hard. I think it's, you know, bowling off-spin in Australia. I don't know if I just got really unlucky with tosses or what wickets we played on, but I can't remember spinning too many balls or getting the ball to off the straight too many times. And, you know, it was a hard grind, but I loved it. It was good fun.
Well, one other thing, Johnny, as well, is that in Victoria, when they had first brought the drop-ins in when you came down, everyone bowled first. So as a home team, and the tradition was that you'd always bat first, but Victoria almost changed that mantra where we'd win the toss and straight away bowl. And opposition sides hadn't worked that out. They'd come down and still bat. And so for a spinner, I remember we had many conversations later on down the track how frustrating it was as a spinner not to get recognition for the output that you're actually giving. I mean, let's be honest, the ball doesn't turn off the bloody square on a MCG drop-in. It does nothing. Yeah. There's no footmarks. Yeah. There's no dustpan. There's absolutely jack shit for a spinner to operate.
I think one of our big KPIs under, you know, Mick O'Sullivan, who was doing our stats and whatnot, was, you know, percentage of maidens bowled. And I took that as a bit of a mantle because, you know, we had such a good fast bowling attack. You know, my role was pretty much in that Paul Jackson mould for Queensland. It was just to, like, bowl tight overs, get through to the new ball and get your quicks back on after they'd had a little bit of a rest. So I think I did all right in terms of, you know, tying up an end and things like that, but that doesn't reflect very well when you look at your stats and things like that. And
yeah, I remember it being a frustration of yours. I remember talking to you about it. It always come up around contract time because the people in charge of that time would only look at statistics. I often found it frustrating as well that, well, you can't actually put a quota on the workload that you did to assist the other bowlers to get their rewards.
That's right.
And then you'd look and you go, well, I'm only averaging 35 or 36 for this year. And they go, well, all the good spinners average less than 30 or around 30. And you go, well, it's nearly impossible. I remember talking about that. It was a frustration.
I reckon it's still a weakness in cricket stats, isn't it? That it still doesn't 100%. Measure, pressure from one end, pressure from both ends. You know, I think until they can work out equations, and there's some very smart people out there in other sports that do measure that it actually gets valued and how much you contribute to the pressure built and to winning teams. And you would have benefited from that. You know, bowlers similar to myself, bowling a lot of overs into the breeze, you know, compared to down breeze. But, you know, even batsmen, I suppose, that might not average a lot, but build a lot of partnerships. You know, there's still not really stats for that either.
Yeah, I agree. Like that, the way we measure cricketers, if we're just looking at averages, it's not irrelevant because the best players' averages are generally the best. But like if you get Sachin Tendulkar out, that's got to be worth more to your bowling average than getting Glenn McGrath out
8 times.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why.
8 times.
What, you got Glenn McGrath out 8 times?
Nah, I never bothered with him. But
you know what I mean. Like, so, you know, that world record partnership between Jay Wardner and Sangakkara, 600 and something, you know, boring, drawn test match. That shouldn't be, and then on the other hand, you've got Phil Hughes batting through an innings, scoring 100 or close to 100 at Belrive Oval and carrying his bat, that's got to be worth more than 90 runs or 100 runs.
It should be double. Score. It's like 100 against Netherlands. You just have that divided by 10. So well done on your 20, Hodgson.
That was a valuable 20. We were 3 for 80.
I'm going to get back to, spin in Australia in a sec. I just want to finish your career. So South Australia, Victoria, what about the batsmen who you just rated, who were just a nightmare to bowl to? Have you got a couple of names that come up straight away?
I reckon Buff was like, I loved bowling to left-handers, and I thought I bowled pretty well to left-handers until it came to Buff. He was just another level. Like, he, the same ball, he would could cut you or drive you over the top of cover, and it didn't have an answer. You know, one day, my answer was, you know, one day game I came, I think I did it in Shield cricket to him too, when I bowled to him, I just like, I can't bowl around the wicket to him because it just gives him some angle to hit me through the offside. So I bowled over the wicket trying to hit his pads. That was my...
Just bowling arm balls.
Yeah, pretty much. And then so we played in a mercantile game, the domestic one days, and he was standing like a foot outside leg stump, just offering me the stumps to bowl to. And I was just like, no, I'm not full of that. And I just kept bowling in his pads, and he just stepped the middle stump and to go down the leg, and I caught wide. And I'm like, how do I bowl this guy? I'm saying to the umpire, how do I bowl to him? I can't just put it where he wants it. I've got to be able to squeeze him somehow. That was a nightmare. Anyway, as I said, it was really hard.
And not the only spinner.
I remember that game, Johnny, pretty clearly. It was well and truly. Nah, not at all. It was well and truly before the umpires knew about, you know, batsmen changing guard and things like that as well.
Yeah.
So he didn't know what to do either. So it was just a complete farce for about 5 or 6 minutes of the game.
Yeah.
Hey, Dean, let's get into the coaching side. There was a time when you used to chat, I thought you're going to be the original master chef. I think you're going to be a restaurant extraordinaire. But you went down the coaching path, the spin whisperer. You've been well used around the world in the last few years. But can you talk firstly about, the main guy that you've worked with, the GOAT, Nathan Lyon? You know, how did that linkage happen? Was Nathan proactive? You talk about spinners struggling in Australia, and they have, but between you two guys, you've found a way to be effective in Australian conditions.
Yeah. Thanks, Flem. I didn't think I would be a coach. As you said, I liked my food and whatnot. And towards the end of my career in South Australia, I went to the PD, personal development manager, and said, you know, wouldn't mind being a chef. And she goes, oh, we can organise that, you know, take you down to the TAFE and you can talk to a few people down there, blah, blah, blah. So I go down to the TAFE thinking, okay, they've got something sorted out for me. And I go in and this guy goes, all right, mate, what do you want to do? And I said, well, yeah, I want to, like, learn to be a chef, but I've got to play cricket on Saturdays. And he goes, oh, no, that's not going to work. That's the main day in hospitality. And that was the end of it. And so that was the end of my cooking dream. Finished with South Australia and moved back to Sydney. And one of my mates was involved at Mossman Cricket Club and Warwick Adlam. And he got me back there, and I did some coaching there with Marty Haywood, who played for New South Wales.
The Moose.
Great bloke. Yeah,
Two very good men. Adlam and Moose.
Yeah, great fellas. Moose and I were doing some coaching at Mossman, and then a couple of years later, I think Brian McFadgen might have been, was he in charge of the academy of that for a little period, Clemmer?
I reckon he was.
He was in charge at some stage, yeah.
He threw him, yeah. He sort of said, do you want to come up and do the, scholarship coach role? So we went up in 12 years ago. What's that? 2008. And sort of fell into coaching. You know, Terry Jenner was still running the spin program. Ashley Mallett was still around. And so I'd stand next to those two watching them coach and marvel at what they were seeing. And I don't know if a lot of it was just talk or they were unbelievable coaches. I'm not sure, but you know, learn a lot on how I would go about things just by watching those guys coach. And then my scholarship year ended, and it was a great year. We had, so my other job was to look after the boys at the Goldsborough Apartments. So we had David Warner and Johnny Holland and Matty Wade and Steve O'Keefe, and it was a really good intake. You know, some few troublemakers, but it was like good fun. And I was the house parent. I was in charge of them. And you know, it's probably not a good idea to have a bullet loader as the house parent, but we had some good laughs, and yeah, it was good fun. And then after that year, they said, well, we don't really have a spin program as such. Would you be interested in running that? And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. So dived into that. And then we used to go around the states and look at all the local spinners and, I suppose try and help identify, guys who we saw with some talent and whatnot. And I suppose that's our trip to Canberra. Came across a young Nath Lyon who was probably 18, and he was just a skinny kid who, you know, wasn't overly impressive in terms of what he was bowling, sort of bowling with closed action and around himself. And, he obviously got some revs on the ball, but it didn't translate into shape or spin off the wicket or turn and bounce off the wicket. Mark Higgs was working with him. Not sure if it was that year or in the years coming. So that was the first time we met him. And then we sort of got together, Higgsy, and spoke about, what he could do. We straightened him up. Higgsy should take a lot of credit for that. And then I suppose just the relationship continued from there. And then I think Nate's biggest challenge then was breaking into first class cricket, which Chuck gave him, Darren Berry gave him a great opportunity in South Australia, and he did well for them in 2020 cricket, and then he went from there. And his biggest challenge was believing in himself, and I think that's any sportsman's challenge, particularly in cricket, having belief in and feeling wanted and having the sense of belonging in a change room. And that period that Australia cricket went through looking for the next Shane Warne.
And Dee, just in between, is it doubly hard? And you would have experienced that, the fast bowlers have their own group. Batsmen are together, the opening batsmen are together, possibly the spinner and the wicketkeeper miss out.
Yeah, I think so. And it's something that, it's definitely something that I've spoken to Johnny Holland about. It, like, you come into first class cricket as a spinner and the stars have aligned and you've got runs on the board and the wicket's deteriorated, it hasn't rained, and they throw you the ball as a relatively young cricketer, and they go, all right, we'll win us the game now. And that's your job on day four, day five to win the. So it's huge pressure. And it's probably the first time that you've ever seen a wicket like that as well. So it's a different way of bowling rather than bowling, on a day one wicket in club cricket every week. And that's going to be a real issue with no second 11 cricket in the coming years. I don't understand how people are going to understand how to play a reverse swinging ball and how to bat on and bowl on, deteriorating wickets. It's going to be a real hole in the learning process.
I don't think it matters, Johnny, because we've had such a good record in Asia over the last two decades. So.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got such a good winning record over there. I think they've got it covered.
So you reckon it's ingrained, is it now, Hodgie?
Yeah. I think they've well and truly ticked that box off. So our futures, we're going to have a great Asian next two decades because we'll play on non-turning wickets, on dropping wickets, and I'm sure our batsmen will cope pretty well.
And Dee, what about with Nathan Lyon now? Like, we know he's the greatest and he's found a way, he used to get under a lot of pressure, not getting wickets in the second innings. That's fine. He gets wickets here and away. Now when you catch up, is it more just topping up and making sure that he's at the best of his game and not, sliding a little bit?
Yeah, I think, like, it's really easy with Nath now. Like, we've worked with each other for so long that it's only like a five. We have a bowl and it's like 5 minutes, and if things aren't happening that well, which generally now he knows his game so well, he probably doesn't need someone there all the time. It's just a quick catch up, a couple of little tweaks here and there, and he's away again. The thing that I push for him the most now is like how are you still developing your game? What can you add to your game? Because his stock ball is one of the best stock balls we've seen from a finger spinner probably ever. But he's so in love with bowling it that he's very reluctant to bowl anything else. I think he bowled that backspinning, what do you call it, Jeff?
Yeah.
To get Jack's Rudolph out. How long ago was that? That was so long ago. And I don't think he's bowled it since. You know, it's trying to encourage him to bowl a ball, particularly to a left-hander that hits the stumps, which makes your stock ball even more effective.
And, Dee, what about, I think he's Australia's most important player because he's irreplaceable at the moment. Like, Pat Cummins, number one quick, but we'll bring in James Pattinson, Smith to a degree, but with Lyon, there's no automatic second in charge, is there?
No, that's right. You tell me who's the next best. I think Mitchell Swepson's. So I think he's really developing, but I don't think anyone's ready, are they? As a spinner, like you, I don't think you're ready until you go. Warney wasn't ready. Hardly any of them been ready in terms of going in and expecting them to perform from ball one. So you've got to pick the right person and then give them time to develop at that level, I believe.
The pace attack, you do have some luxury. I reckon, they're very potent. So, the spinner, while they're still in their peak, the top four, you probably don't need to do that. But, hey, boys, that's it. We're out of time. It's a bit it's a bit like a Johnny D World Cup innings. It had a lot of shots. But it was all over too quickly. Hey, Johnny D, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the Spin Whisperer brand. And we look forward to you bringing through the next generation of spin bowler in Australia.
Yeah, thanks, Johnny. It's been good fun.
Seven balls, six sixes, seven fours, and has become equal the fourth fastest century in one day international cricket. What an effort. By gee, what will he do now? How can he back that up? Make him Prime Minister.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.